It's no secret a key part of U.S. President Donald Trump's economic agenda is a weaker currency. But he wouldn't be the first. From Nixon in the 1970s to Reagan in the 1980s, past presidents have also deliberately looked to weaken the dollar to try and rebalance global trade. Kevin Hebner, Managing Director and Global Investment Strategist at TD Epic, has just come out with a report on this topic called "The Dollar is Our Currency, But It's Your Problem. Rebalancing Requires a Much Weaker Dollar." He joins us now. Of course, all that research I was quoting at the beginning came from you about previous presidents, so I should give credit where credit is due. It's lovely to see you.
Great. Thanks, Kim.
You have, again, in the report, you talk about the much weaker U.S. dollar as you see it. And you give four core reasons as to why you think that's actually been coming to pass. So I'm not complicated. I just want to cut to the four reasons to understand them. So the first one is that you believe right now that the U.S. dollar is 10 to 20% expensive. Tell us why and based on what.
Yeah. And this is similar, as in your opening comments, where it was in 71 with the Nixon shock and 85 with the Plaza Accord under Reagan. It's currently 15 to 20% overvalued, and we have the one chart that illustrates it. It represents an average of a bunch of different valuation approaches to currencies, purchasing power parity, really effective exchange rates, the Big Mac Index, which compares the price of a Big Mac in lots of different countries, and so on. So the dollar is that much expensive, and then cheap currencies include the CAD, say by about 10%, the Chinese renminbi, about 20%, and the Japanese yen, almost 40%, extremely undervalued currencies.
And you give, actually, I'll just jump right into the next one, because you've got this one thesis on the, and correct me, 15% perhaps overvalued right now. This one I think is interesting in terms of the next one, is that you say that U.S. dollar assets are over-owned now. Tell me just a bit about just why? How do you quantify that?
Yeah, so at the end of 2024, there were three real bets in markets overall. One was very long Meg 7, overall longest U.S. equities, and then long the U.S. dollar. And that had been built up over a long time. You could argue it's been built up over the last 12 to 14 years, but with American exceptionalism, particularly in terms of AI and tech developments, digital tech, a lot of money flowing into U.S. dollar assets and bidding them higher. So it's a process that's been going on for quite a long time, and we think it's close to peaking.
Why do you think it's close to peaking?
It's close to peaking because you have an administration that wants a weaker dollar and will be putting various impediments to capital inflows into the U.S. The exceptionalism of the U.S. in terms of tech, that's going to remain. But other aspects of tech that are more worrisome, a Fed that's no longer independent, the rule of law that's being challenged, and other aspects of American exceptionalism are waning.
Your third piece that you highlight here is America's imbalances, unsustainable and deteriorating ever further. I think a lot of people hear about that. This both trade deficit, international investment position. Maybe just tell us about the trade deficit first.
So the trade deficit now has a run rate of $1 trillion a year. It's enormous. There's never been anything in history similar to this. And the U.S. has had a small trade deficit for a long time, but it really kicked into high gear in the early 2000s. That was the first China shock after China joined the WTO. And then it's accelerated again in the last couple of years with the second China shock. And this is very different types of goods. They've moved up the value chain, and now it's about batteries, EVs, a lot of highly valued manufactured goods. So it's affecting certainly the U.S. and a lot of other places, including the EU in some emerging markets. But as a consequence, China has a trade surplus of about $1 trillion, and the U.S. has the mirror image, a deficit of about $1 trillion.
Now, in terms of the triple trade or triple deficits, it's also there's trade, there's budget, international investment. The budget deficit, just to talk on that briefly.
Yeah. So in Stephen Arand's view, he's one of Trump's key economic advisors, there is an insatiable demand for U.S. treasuries from foreign investors, particularly Asian central banks, for example, the People's Bank of China. So you get a constant bid for treasuries, which means there's no discipline on the budgetary process. So you can have a budget deficit, currently 6.5% of GDP, the highest ever, except for recessions and war. And there's no discipline on DC to do anything about that. And so that's one type of sort of excess
demand.
Or imbalance,
yeah, yeah.
The demand for coming from Asia. But also, we see, as the chart here shows, is the money coming in. And so if you have a big current account deficit, you need to have a capital account surplus.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what this chart shows. And it means that foreign investors own roughly 85% of GDP in terms of U.S. assets, equities, fixed income, and so on. 2 decades ago, it was 12%, so fairly moderate. It's become quite extreme, and there's nothing been anything like this before in history, and in no sense is this sustainable.
Right, and it's also, you know, the benefit, of course, to the Chinese is that when you bid up the U.S. Treasuries, or buying the U.S. Treasury, I should say, you're also keeping that effect on your currency staying lower, which makes it much more attractive to keep that virtuous or not virtuous, depending on where you sit in transaction.
Yeah, and so we've had this weird thing where the trade deficit keeps getting bigger and bigger, and the dollar appreciates.
Mm-hmm.
And normally you would think that there has to be some type of equilibrating mechanism. If you have a bigger trade deficit, the currency should weaken, so that exports are more competitive, imports are more expensive. And that doesn't happen because you've got this bid for U.S. dollar assets, particularly, and this is a view of Stephen Moran within the Trump administration. He's chair of the Council of Economic Advisors and now has been nominated to be on the Fed board, that you have this insatiable demand for treasuries from reserve managers in Asia, and this prevents equilibrium from happening. So you, at the same time as you have a bigger and bigger trade deficit, you actually get a stronger and stronger currency. This is unsustainable, and it's bad. The previous Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, she thought that when they sent us their exports and buy our treasuries, we should send them a thank you note. That was the old view for decades. But the realization now is you do that, you deindustrialize, and you create all sorts of vulnerabilities. We can't make semiconductors, we don't have rare earths, all sorts of things, these choke points. And it didn't matter in a time when China was relatively small and China was an ally, but if the world sees China as an existential adversary and China is willing to weaponize these choke points, then this is not sustainable.
We've gone through three reasons why you think there's, of course, going to be a weaker U.S. dollar. And just to recap for people, valuations, U.S. dollar is 10 to 20% too expensive. You say it's the dominance, it's overowned. The U.S. assets are overowned. And then finally, just the persistent trade balances that were, I should say, imbalances, trade budget and capital accounts. Your fourth reason you talk about is, to quote you, the Mar-a-Lago Accord. The White House wants a new global economic order facilitated by a markedly weak U.S. dollar, for all the reasons you've probably been talking about.
Yeah, yeah. And so this is an expression from Stephen Moran, the person who's been nominated to be on the Fed board, currently chair of the Council of Economic Advisors. And he's been very important in the Trump administration. And so his view, and it's a takeoff on the Plaza Accord in 85 with Reagan, and has similarities to the Nixon shock in 75 and 71. But his view is the reason we have these capital account inflows, and the capital account's what drives the current account and the trade deficits. And the capital account is driven by Asian central banks keeping their currencies undervalued as a form of modern mercantilism. So you have to address the structural reason, because we've had this problem for a long time. So we have to be coming up with a new bargain. And there's really nobody who thinks that you should have capital flows, large number of capital flows coming into a country without any type of impediments on it. There's no reason empirically or theoretically to think that that's something that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something the United States has been doing the last 20 years, but it doesn't make sense. So in his view, what we need to do is have a Mar-a-Lago Accord. And so this goes back to the rebalancing of the economy that President Trump wants. So you want lower trade deficits, you want reindustrialization as part of this, And you want, I think broadly, a restructuring and fewer choke points is, mm-hmm. is the third key part of this. And so Mark Carney, he has an expression, he said recently, that the U.S. is beginning to monetize their hegemony.
Yes.
So hegemony is a polite word for empire, and that's what this is about. The U.S. provides three public goods to the world: access to the U.S. consumer, U.S. defense umbrella, and access to the U.S. dollar-based global financial system. So people have to start paying for this access through tariffs. He also wants people, well, countries investing in the United States, creating jobs, and increasing military spending, including procuring more from U.S. companies. So this is part of the Mar-a-Lago Accord. And then with that, there could be specific policies to discourage capital inflows from Asian central banks. So capital restrictions, it could be bond swaps that you'd be doing, like a 2-year for 30-year, if that bond had been bought by an Asian central bank. It could be direct FX intervention. For example, dollar China is kept at a level that's far too high, and the People's Bank intervenes every day on the fix with that. So the U.S. could get involved. It could be creating a sovereign wealth fund to help the rebalancing, reindustrialization, and reducing the trade deficit. So Stephen Moran posits a lot of ideas, sort of thinking out loud, but the idea is that eventually we'll have to move in this direction, moving in baby steps with a lot of forward guidance so you don't create too much market volatility when this happens.
All those things you mentioned are done through different vehicles, different organizations that exist within the economy that are not currently under the control of the president.
Yes.
And so tell me, from a news standpoint, we're hearing more and more noise about the Fed and the U.S. president and how things could change. And maybe you could just take me through your thought process of what you might see.
Yeah. So broadly, President Trump thinks of an all-in-government approach to economic policy. So you don't want to have one agency doing one thing and another agency moving in a different direction. Everyone should be moving in the same direction, including the agencies that have previously been independent, of which the Fed is the most notable. And many of Moran's proposals require closer coordination between the Treasury and the Fed in particular. So recently, for example, the idea of getting Lisa Cook, one of the Fed governors, to resign, that would allow Trump to make an appointment. And then in that case, three of the current Fed governors would be Trump policy supporters. Mm-hmm. Stephen Moran will probably be confirmed next month, which would give four to seven. So which gives him majority control. And that's important for a lot of things, one of which is in February of next year, all 12 regional Fed presidents' third term expires and they need to get reappointed. The Fed board can veto any appointment, and to make sure that the people getting appointed are people who are on board with the Trump economic agenda. And then this thing heats up a bit more where next May you have Chair Powell's term expire, so then President Trump can nominate someone for that position, and then you'd have 5 of 7 people on the Fed board being supportive of Trump's economic agenda. And that allows him to do a lot of things, including invoking Section 13.3 of the Federal Reserve Act, which means you can declare an emergency, give emergency power, declare some type of emergency, and then you can create special purpose vehicles and use the Fed's balance sheet for different economic policies that you deem critical or emergencies. This could include critical minerals, manufacturing semiconductors. It could include quite a few things, but you have access to the world's biggest balance sheet. That's pretty enticing.
It is, and sorry, when you say it could mean, it's when you say critical minerals or those, to create funds to invest, is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So he's talked a lot about creating a sovereign wealth fund in the view that the 10% stake in Intel is the beginning of what they'd like to do in a number of critical sectors, including semiconductors, but beyond that. And so some type of sovereign wealth fund, possibly funded through this type of means in conjunction with the Fed's balance sheet, to give increased control of the economy to help Trump with his objectives. And the objectives, again, reducing the trade deficit, reindustrialization, reducing choke points. And in many ways, I think few people would criticize the objectives of Trump economic policies. It's pretty easy to criticize the means and the tone. Mm-hmm. And so what we're trying to do is see beyond the noise where this is trying to go, what the policy implications are, and then what it means for markets.
You know, historically, mm-hmm. what happens with U.S. markets when the U.S. dollar weakens?
So we're thinking, for example, in terms of bond markets, there'd be curve steepening. So the short end comes in a lot. That certainly was something Trump would see. As we're seeing today, the 30-year and maybe the 10-year would go up or stay where it is now. In terms of what it means for equity markets, it means easier financial conditions because a lot of countries and companies outside the United States, they borrow in U.S. dollar or other hard currencies. So if the U.S. dollar weakens, their lending terms ease, so financial conditions improve. So this is good for cyclical markets. Mm-hmm. So this chart shows emerging markets, highly cyclical, very strong correlation with the U.S. dollar over the last three decades or so. Within the S&P, the sectors that would do well would be cyclical sectors, materials, industrials, energy, things like that, versus stable sectors like consumer staples, utilities, and so on. Would do a bit less well. And then in terms of regional equity markets, we mentioned emerging markets, the EU, they're very cyclical, mm-hmm. they would tend to do well. And then the markets like the US, more stable markets would tend to benefit less from a weaker US dollar. The purpose of this chart is to show what happens if you hedge or don't hedge your U.S. dollar exposure, your S&P exposure as a Canadian investor.
Yeah, and I want to just pause there because I actually just, this is very important. People need to pay attention here on in because so many Canadian investors have had so many wonderful tailwinds for decades.
Yes. Yeah, and so for at least the last 12 years, ex post at least, the right approach for Canadian investors was not to hedge your U.S. dollar asset exposure, equities or fixed income, whatever. And so you've had the benefit of the underlying equity markets or fixed income markets plus the currency. So you've got this sort of double benefit from it. So the right thing to do, and this anytime this line is in positive territory, it means that not hedging was the right thing to do, at least on an ex post term. Going forward, we think the risks to the US dollar are now two-sided, we think to the downside. Mm-hmm. So you're taking currency exposure by having S&P or other asset exposure in the United States, you're unlikely to get rewarded for this risk in your portfolio, so you should think about hedging. Every person's different, every portfolio is different, so you can't say you should have an 80% hedge all the time or 100. You have to talk to your investment advisor or portfolio manager or give some thought to it.
Yeah.
But you are taking risk through FX. You're likely not to get rewarded for it. So the last 12 years, the right thing to do is not to think about it.
Yep.
Going forward, we think it's very important to think about it.
And when you think about part of this, the cost to hedge these things as well, too, which we've got a chart here where you show how people need to think about hedging with various currencies.
Yeah. And so the line for investing in the U.S., it's the green line, and just represents the three-year return versus the in U.S. dollars versus Canada. And currently, the U.S. curve's above the Canadian one, so it costs you to hedge U.S. dollar exposure about 150 basis points a year. We think this is going to come down to about 75 basis points because the Fed is just starting their cutting cycle. The Bank of Canada is close to the end, so this is going to come down. But right now, it's 150 basis points to hedge. Likely a year from now, it'll be closer to 50 basis points to hedge. So there is some cost, but we think the U.S. dollar is going to decline by, say, 15% over the next 3 years or so. So we think the benefits of hedging are going to exceed the cost. So it still makes sense to do. But it's important to recognize right now that there is a carry penalty to hedging U.S. dollar assets right now.
I've only got about 30 seconds, but if you were to say to me 15% over the next 3 years, what are some of the signals you're going to be looking for to see that's going to be happening?
So the first half of this year, we saw the U.S. dollar weaken, and that catalyst was Trump's tariff policies. The next catalyst, I think, comes in play maybe in February, maybe in May, But with the changes in Fed independence, the monetary policy structure, this is a key part of American exceptionalism, and this is waning. But I think this is going to be an important catalyst for the next leg down in the dollar.